day, everybody. Welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, October 27th. I am Kevin Rogers here at the microphone. Glad to have you listening as always. Let's start by taking a look at the titles of the articles on the front page of the paper. Griffith Company office fire has been ruled arson. Fort Dodge Community School District sees sliding enrollment increase. A new look for downtown on Central Avenue. Bo Daddy makes his initial appearance for attempted murder. And candidate Shulton makes one more bid in Fort Dodge for the congressional seat. Those are the titles of the different articles from the front page of today's Messenger. A fire that destroyed a former architecture office building on Kenya Road about 2 weeks ago was intentionally set, according to fire investigators. The fire that engulfed the former offices of Griffith Company Architects at 709 Kenyon Road was ruled an arson, Fort Dodge Fire Department Chief Steve Hergenreiter said. Four investigators from the Fort Dodge Fire Department, along with an insurance investigator, assessed the damage and remains of the structure and determined the blaze had been set on purpose. The exact circumstances of how the fire was set are not being released at this time as it remains an active investigation, Hergenreiter said. The fire started at about 7:20 on October 12th and was called in by multiple passersby. The blaze quickly engulfed the A-frame building, sending flames shooting as high as 30 feet in the air. It took nearly an hour to get the fire under control, and firefighters remained on the scene until about 12:30. The next morning, putting out the remaining hot spots. No injuries were reported the night of the fire. Fort Dodge Police Department Captain Ryan Gruenberg confirmed that the fire and police departments are continuing to investigate this arson. Any witnesses or anyone who may have seen something suspicious around the property at 709 Kenyon Road between 7 and 7:15 p.m. the evening of Monday, October 12th, are asked to contact the Fort Dodge Police Department at 573-2323 or contact Crime Stoppers anonymously at 515-573-1444. The Fort Dodge man charged with attempted murder for allegedly stabbing a 71-year-old victim made his initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court Monday morning. Bond for Reno Bodetti, age 37, was set at $250,000 cash only. Police were called to 504 North 3rd Street at 4:40 a.m. Saturday in response to reports of a man stabbing a relative with a knife. Officers arrived to find Bodetti in the residence, where the victim was found stabbed several times in the neck and abdomen. The victim was transported by the Fort Dodge Fire Department to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Bodetti has an extensive history of criminal charges, though most charges have been various levels of misdemeanors. Six felony cases for him appear in the court records online, some of which show a gradual increase in violent tendencies. In November 2008, he was charged with first-degree robbery and intimidation with a dangerous weapon, Class B and D felonies, respectively. Former charge was dismissed by the court, and the latter was reduced to assault, use, display of a weapon, an aggravated misdemeanor. In January 2017, Fort Dodge Police complaints charged the defendant with third-degree kidnapping, saying he bound a woman with an extension cord and belt, leading police on a chase. He was found guilty of false imprisonment and eluding by a jury and sentenced up to 1 year in prison for each charge to be conserved consecutively minus time served in jail. Bodetti's preliminary hearing for attempted murder has been set for Friday. The Fort Dodge Community School District has seen a slight increase in enrollment during the 2021 school year. Superintendent Jesse Ulrich told the school board Monday night, between the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2020, the district has seen an increase of 5 students for a total of 3,673 students in transitional kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not the norm across the state of Iowa, Ulrich told the school board. In fact, there are only two schools in the entire urban education network of Iowa who are reporting stable or increased enrollment. Everyone else is reporting drastic decreases in students. Ulrich credited the district's Board of Education, leadership, and teachers for the increase in enrollment. It is a reflection of the confidence that our community has within our system, he said. The school board also approved an incentive offering for district employees who are eligible for early retirement during the 2021 school year. The early incentive the early retirement incentive includes a $1,000 early notification bonus and accumulated six-day compensation. The accumulated sick day compensation is calculated as 50% of the employee's per diem pay times the number of unused sick days, up to 150 times 250%. The early retirement incentive is paid for out of our management fund, and the savings are felt within our general fund, Ulrich explained. This year, if every eligible district employee took the incentive package for early retirement, the total package would cost about $1.6 million. Traditionally, only about 40% of our staff take an early retirement incentive package. Employees who wish to take early retirement must be at least 55 years old on or before June 30th, 2021, have a minimum of 10 consecutive years of work within the district on or before June 30th, 2021, and are retiring at the end of the 2021 school year. Eligible district employees have until December 11th to submit an early retirement application to the district's Human Resources Office. Back to the front page of the paper. A New Look is the title of the next article. Central Avenue in downtown Fort Dodge may have designated bike lanes and less on-street parking in the future. Also, a dead-end section of 11th Street south of Central Avenue could be closed to traffic to create a plaza, and more landscaping could be added to public right-of-ways. Those are all possibilities under a downtown streetscape plan introduced to the City Council Monday evening. Implementing all elements of the plan drafted by Snyder & Associates of Ankeny would cost an estimated $14 million. However, any work to implement the plan's recommendation will not happen anytime soon. The council took no action on the plan Monday. Although listed on the council's agenda, the Central Avenue draft concept plan, the proposal covers more than Central Avenue. The section of Central Avenue between 3rd and 12th Streets is covered along with all the streets that run north and south in that area. Staffers from Snyder & Associates participating in the meeting via internet explained the elements of the plan. Generally, the driving lanes on Central Avenue would be narrower to accommodate the bike lanes. The driving lanes around the city square would also be narrower. The bike lanes could be at the same height as the street, or they could be at the same height of the sidewalks, according to Tim West, a landscape architect with Snyder & Associates. The plan envisions what West called parklets at different spots along Central Avenue. Each parklet, he said, would have some benches or other seating. Under the proposal, parking lots would be surrounded by fences of brick and metal. The plan also includes upgrades to a north-south walkway in the 700 block of Central Avenue. In two locations, the plan calls for closing part of what is now a street. South 11th Street between Central Avenue and the dead end is one such spot. The other is the piece of Central Avenue that is north of the triangle land near Central Avenue and 12th Street called Veterans Park. Images of the proposed new landscape show lots of greenery. Councilman Kim Allstott, who is a member of the Pride and Community Appearance, questioned how all those plants could be properly cared for. He said PICA is so busy taking care of plants and trees elsewhere in the community that it can't possibly take on the responsibility for all the proposed new plants. PICA is not in favor of all those plants, by the way, Allstott said. J.D. Schulten, running for the congressional seat in this area, has been in Fort Dodge, making one more bid. In a final week of campaigning for Election Day, 4th District Congressional candidate J.D. Schulten stood tall for all under an overcast sky Monday evening for one of his final tours of 2020. While standing tall is not hard to do in the bed of a truck at 6'2", the unseasonably freezing weather made it undoubtedly less appealing in the Fort Museum and Frontier Village parking lot, where about 25 cars listened to the Democratic challenger over the radio. With polling and political forecasts in other districts predicting another blue wave in Congress this year, Shulton remains optimistic even after many have written off his campaign in a district where registered Republicans substantially outnumber Democrats. The candidate said internal polling shows a closer race than the most recent one from Monmouth University, which shows State Senator Randy Feenstra leading 48-43%. But in the home stretch, the former baseball player told the Messenger that he does share one trait with U.S. Representative Steve Keen, the soon-to-be ex-congressman said Feenstra, since Feenstra ousted him in the Republican primary. Shulton believes the race for a district that has eluded Democrats for many decades may less be less about party affiliation than it is about establishment attitudes rooted in northwestern Iowa. If you take all the controversy and racism aside, King was anti-establishment. We're anti-establishment, said Shulton, so we've picked up a lot of votes. The history of this district is more anti-establishment than anything else. In his 374-town tour of service mark formerly touted by King before his final victory against Shulton, Shulton said that their campaign has met over 700 former King supporters who have voted for him or about to vote for him this year. But despite his campaign's high note of building a grassroots campaign from scratch in a district with dilapidated Democratic outreach infrastructure, Shulton regretted that the campaign still hasn't managed to shake the stigma that lingered over it 2 years ago. There's a perception that this race is not winnable, he said. The last cycle and this cycle are parallels. At this point in the last campaign, his internal polls showed him within 1% of King, spurring a burst of fundraising that helped him finish 3 points away from King, closer than any Democratic candidate ever got to defeating the incumbent. The latest internal poll with the Feenstra campaign, cited by the Sioux City Journal on October 15th, showed a 23-point lead over Shulton. Shulton's own internal poll showed him trailing Feenstra by 5 points. This time he said the campaign is much better off despite the choice to decline Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee funds. As attack ads on the airway attempt to disparage other statewide Democratic candidates through ties to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Shulton believes that the move reinforces campaign's anti-establishment image in a way that could be a key part to winning voters with the registration disadvantage. On the last two campaign trails, he's gone out of his way to distance himself from the party leader being weaponized against Democrats who accept party campaign funding, Shulton told the Messenger that a big part of his run has required that he articulate himself as a candidate, a populist reflection, he said, does not mirror how the Democratic Party is characterized, particularly as it is characterized by conservative pundits. The DCCC is looking for somebody who's just going to be a puppet for the establishment, Shulton said. From Sioux City Sioux, the humble RV that Shulton has called home for the last two campaign cycles. The fact that I turned down DCCC, the fact that I want to change leadership, just shows that I'm willing to take on my party if need be. Besides, he said, fundraising a campaign dictated from Sioux City wouldn't have made it possible for him to reach voters and the approach he's taking. Standing on an F-150 truck bed was his manifestation of retail politics that seemed to warm the small crowd on a cold night where horn honks were the new applause. And the applause was plentiful for a small speech that packed a punch, excoriating the status quo maintained by Washington policies, he said, don't work in rural Iowa's favor. Among Shulton's most popular applause lines were calls to scrap the income cap on Social Security contributions, matched the fervor of other global competitors seeking to beat America's economy and make life in rural America feasible. As the United States Senate confirmed Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, cementing a 6-3 conservative majority, expected to hear a challenge of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, after Election Day, Shulton said Congress must work to ensure health care protections for those with pre-existing conditions, the number of whom is expected to skyrocket in light of the pandemic. We are the wealthiest nation in the world and have far too many people that rely on begging to pay for their medical costs, he said to the lot after making note of the same gas station collection jars he's talked about since his 2018 bid. We've got to focus on each other. We've got to focus on people. That's why I'm sick of these career politicians going to D.C. and leaving the rest of us behind. Shulton said to the loudest honks of the evening, when I get elected, I'm not selling out. At the end of the day, I will come back and look you in the eye on every single issue. While D.C. policies continue to favor Wall Street rather than Main Street metrics, Shulton said that we need working class candidates out there who understand the needs of the district, who show up for the needs of the district and the people. And there's a handful of pictures associated with this article as people sit in their vehicles listening to the candidate. Heading over to page 2 of the Messenger from our files on this date in 2005 in October. Shows a picture of Iowa Central graduate Crystal Serwick. She makes a copy Wednesday morning in the business department offices at the school. Messenger poll question ongoing is, do you plan to get a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as it's available? To render an answer, you can go to messengernews.net. There's a picture in the paper on page 2 of Fort Dodge Fire Department at an apartment fire. An unattended candle was the cause of a small apartment fire at 215 North 12th Street just before noon on Monday. According to Fort Dodge Fire Department Chief Steve Hergenreder, the occupant of the basement apartment had left a candle unattended, which ignited the fire. The building has 7 units and is owned by Pat Harvey. The basement unit's living room and bedroom have heavy fire, heat, and smoke damage, Hergenreder said. There was also smoke damage to the first and second floor. There were no injuries reported, and all occupants were able to get out safely, the fire chief said. Fort Dodge Fire Department was assisted by the Fort Dodge Police Department and Mid-American Energy. Today is October 27th, as I read this. And from this date in history, today's highlight, on October 27th, 1904, the first rapid transit subway, the IRT, was inaugurated in New York City. On this date in 1787, the first of the Federalist Papers, a series of essays calling for ratification of the United States Constitution, was published. In 1941, the Chicago Daily Tribune dismissed the possibility of war with Japan, editorializing, "She cannot attack us, that is a military impossibility. Even our base at Hawaii is beyond the effective striking power of her fleet." And of course, about 6 weeks later, they learned otherwise, didn't they? 1954, United States Air Force Colonel Benjamin O. Davis Jr. was promoted to Brigadier General, the first black officer to achieve the rank in the United States Air Force. In 2001, in Washington, the search for deadly anthrax widened to thousands of businesses and 30 mail distribution centers. In 2004, the Boston Red Sox won their first World Series since 1918, sweeping the St. Louis Cardinals in Game 4 by a score of 3-0. 10 years ago, dozens of Jewish extremists hoisting Israeli flags defiantly marched through the Arab-Israeli town of Ifam, chanting death to terrorists and touching off clashes between rock-hurling residents and police. 5 years ago, President Barack Obama, addressing the International Association of Chief of Police in Chicago, defended officers who had come under intense scrutiny amid a breakdown in relations between law enforcement and minority communities, and said police couldn't be expected to contain problems that society refuses to solve. 1 year ago, in an address from the White House, President Donald Trump announced that Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had died after U.S. Special Operations Forces cornered him during a raid in Syria. He blew himself up as United States forces approached. And that is this date in history. An Eagle Grove driver was transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center Monday morning after colliding with a semi-trailer that failed to stop at an intersection. The semi-trailer traveling west on County Road D14 failed to stop at a stop sign at the intersection with Nelson Avenue at about 11:30. Eagle Grove motorist Deborah Burris, traveling south on Nelson Avenue, hit the semi-trailer on its front passenger side, totaling her 2011 Chevy Impala, worth an estimated $25,000 in damage. Burris, 68, was transported via ambulance to Trinity Regional Medical Center with possible injuries, which were not specified in the report. Both drivers were wearing their seatbelts. Grand Island, Nebraska, semi-trailer driver Mike Ike was cited for failure to obey a stop sign. The Iowa State Patrol's incident report indicated that he was distracted from the road while reaching for objects or fallen objects in his cab. The major roads through northwest side of Fort Dodge will be rebuilt in the next few years. In a process the city council launched Monday with a resolution regarding buying some land needed for the project. 3rd Avenue Northwest and Hawkeye Avenue will be reconstructed in a project expected to be completed in 2022. In 2023, the work will be done between 7th Street Northwest and the Hawkeye Avenue Bridge. When the work is done, 3rd Avenue Northwest will have three lanes, one for eastbound traffic, one for westbound traffic, and a center turning lane. A curb on a hill north of the bridge will be reduced. Water mains, sanitary sewers, and storm sewers will be improved. This project is included in the Northwest River District Master Plan approved by the Council in 2015. On Monday, the Council unanimously passed a resolution declaring its intent to buy needed real estate for the project. The resolution enables the Council to use eminent domain to acquire the property if necessary. When eminent domain is invoked, the Chief District Court Judge picks a panel of appraisers who determine the value of the property. The city would then pay the owner that amount and take possession of the land. The intent of the city is to work with the property owners, Councilman Terry Menke said. In other business Monday, the council hired McClure Engineering of Fort Dodge to provide an analysis of the city's water supply at a cost of $295,000. The company will determine the city's current water supply capacity and figure out how much water it can take from the Jordanian and Mississippian aquifers. It will also evaluate the possibility of taking water from surface water such as rivers and lakes. Also on Monday, the council sold two vacant lots. Rundown homes on those lots were demolished previously. A lot in the 500 block of North 7th Street was sold to Scott Etzel at 510 North 7th Street for $500. A lot in the 100 block of North 5th Street was sold to Doug Baker of 185 North 5th Street for $500. An ambulance, a bucket truck to be used by the city electrician, and a pickup were added to the Fort Dodge fleet of vehicles Monday night. The ambulance was purchased from Ed M. Feld Equipment Company of Carroll for $126,000. It will be smaller than the fire department's current ambulances and will be used for long-distance transportation of patients. In a report to the council, Fire Chief Steve Hergenreiter wrote that in 2019, city ambulances traveled about 270,000 miles to hospitals in Des Moines, the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics in Iowa City, and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Buying the new ambulance will provide a more fuel-efficient vehicle for those trips, he wrote. The electrician's truck will have a boom that will extend to 47 feet in the air so that street lights and traffic signals can be repaired. It will cost $159,000. The price includes $51,000 plus to Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota for the chassis and $108,000 to ABM Equipment and Supply of Hopkins, Minnesota for the utility body and boom. The new truck will replace a 2003 Ford now in use. Also, a half-ton pickup with extended cab was purchased from Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota for $29,000 plus. It will replace a 2005 Ford now in use. The City Council voted unanimously to approve the purchases. The Blanda Memorial Art Museum is continuing art opportunities for kids on November 7th. Classes were developed to work virtually yet have the one-on-one capability in creating a piece of art for the participants involved. It is the newest opportunity for the public to enjoy the works on display at the museum. A number of local students participated in the very first virtual class. Children of all ages worked with instructor Marcia Anderson as they learned how to work with a cardboard loom, string, yarn, and other tools to create a weaving during the hour-long class. While the class was in progress, participants were able to ask questions of the teacher about what was going on, or if they were having issues with working with the materials. The interactions were fun, informative, and even a cat got involved in the process in one of the participants' homes while they worked. My two oldest daughters participated in the class, and they had a wonderful time. I thought the class was a success and a great way to connect art classes to the community. By doing virtual classes, we are carrying on a legacy of learning connected to the Blandon, said Eric Anderson, director of the Blandon Memorial Art Museum. Second class to be offered is Still Life with Watercolor, inspired by Marion Smith's painting Silver, 1993, currently on display in the Blandon's West Gallery. Each registered participant can sign up at the Blandon or online at blandon.org. Participants will receive a bag with materials to create the project and instructions on how to create their own watercolor painting. On the day of the class, they will log in to watch it on Facebook, followed along step-by-step with the instructor, Diane O'Hearn. This class will be pre-recorded with the teacher, and while the class is going on, the children can ask questions of staff live during the half-hour-long class. We turn next to the Messenger editorial, which is entitled October is National Pork Month. October has been designated National Pork Month. That makes it an especially good time to reflect on the importance of the pork industry to this state. It's unlikely that anyone who lives in Iowa does not already know that pork production contributes mightily to the economic vitality of the state. It may come as a surprise, however, that hogs raised in Iowa account for more than 30% of U.S. hog production. Iowa ranks as the nation's top hog-producing state. It's also the top state for pork exports. According to the Iowa Pork Producers Association, exports of pork from Iowa totaled more than $2.1 billion in 2018. Iowa's 5,418 pig farms generated work not only in pig production, but also in hog harvesting and pork processing. In all, there are 147,105 Iowa jobs created by the pork industry through direct and indirect and induced jobs. There are pig farmers in every Iowa county. The top five Iowa counties for pig production are Washington, Sioux, Lyon, Hamilton, and Plymouth. Each of these counties has more than 1 million pigs. Iowa producers marketed almost 48 million hogs in 2018. The number of pigs in Iowa in December 2019 was 24.8 million hogs. Livestock production in Iowa supplies about 25% of Iowa's cropland fertilizer needs. This statistical overview of pork production in Iowa illustrates the magnitude of this critical industry. It should leave a little doubt that pork producers help keep Iowa prosperous and are key players in the state's economy. There's good reason, not only for those people who work in the pork industry, but also everyone else who resides in Iowa, to join in celebrating National Pork Month. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. This podcast is, of course, available at iowaradioreading.org. And now it's time to look at the obituary page. The obituary page has an obituary from Clarion for Colleen Johnson. Colleen Ann McDermott Johnson, 86, of Clarion, died Saturday, October 24th. At the Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center in Clarion, private memorial services will be held. Visitation is Wednesday, October 28th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Ewing Funeral Home in Clarion. Those in attendance will be asked to follow social distancing guidelines and encouraged to wear a face covering. Colleen was born March 20th, 1934 in Eagle Grove, the daughter of Mary Agnes and Christopher Henry McDermott. Colleen's siblings included Richard McDermott, Donna McDermott, Zodi, Jack McDermott, and Terry Joe McDermott. Colleen attended Eagle Grove schools her entire life, graduating in 1952. During high school and immediately following high school, she worked at Dr. Smith Hoganson's clinic in Eagle Grove. At a dance in Fort Dodge, she met the love of her life, Jimmy O. Johnson. The couple was united in marriage on June 5, 1954 in Eagle Grove. Raising eight children, they made their home in Estherville, Des Moines, and moved to Lake Cornelia in 1970. Jimmy and Colleen moved into Clarion in 2005. Colleen lived her entire life loving, giving, and caring for others. She was truly passionate about welcoming and loving every person she met. She loved flowers, gardening, canning, sewing, and somehow always managed to whip up a feast to feed the masses. She was a member of St. John's Catholic Church and rarely missed. She served the church in many ways. She enjoyed Bible study and her grandmom's group with her dear friends. She was a CNA and worked at the Clarion Care Center for a short time. Later, she worked as a home health aide for 20-plus years for Wright County Public Health Department. After retirement, Colleen and Jimmy enjoyed time with family and friends. She was preceded in death by her parents, brothers Richard and Jack, sister Donna. She was also preceded in death by her son David Hugh Johnson and daughter Teresa Elizabeth Johnson Simmons, son-in-law Dan Gangstead, grandsons Alex Lawson, and Joshua Gangstead, and her beloved husband Jimmy O. Johnson. She is survived by her baby brother Joe and Jerry McDermott, brother-in-law Thomas, Pete, and Meg Johnson. She is also survived by her children Lee and Deb Johnson, son-in-law Steve Simmons, John and Lois Johnson, Patty and Pat Gangstead, Kay and Brian Marker, Laura and Jonathan Williams, and Jake and Carrie Ann Johnson, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Colleen will be remembered as a loving wife, mother, grandmother, and friend. The family wishes to thank all of you for your care and concern. Loffisweilers has services pending for Jordan Mundy and services pending for Landon Smith. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. Looking at the police records from Friday, two domestic calls were reported. A noise disturbance was reported in the 900 block of 6th Avenue North. A noise disturbance was reported in the 1500 block of 4th Avenue North. Theft was reported in the 700 block of 1st Avenue South. A car accident was reported in the 300 block of Avenue M West. Theft was reported in the 1400 block of 1st Avenue North. A car accident at North 13th and 7th Avenue North. A suspicious person was reported at 3rd South and South 8th Street. A fight was reported in the 2500 block of 5th Avenue South. A hit and run was reported in the 1500 block of 6th Avenue North. A suspicious person was reported in the 3100 block of 5th Avenue South. A suspicious person was reported near 18th Avenue North and Nolcrest Drive. And a fight was reported in the 500 block of Central Avenue. On Saturday, two domestic calls were reported. Loud music was reported in the 1200 block of 9th Avenue North. A car accident was reported in the 1300 block of 3rd Avenue Northwest. A fire was reported in the 500 block of Central Avenue. An assault was reported in the 300 block of South 14th Street. A person with a weapon was reported in the 500 block of North 3rd Street. A gas drive-off was reported in the 300 block of 2nd Avenue South. A car accident was reported in the 3000 block of 1st Avenue South. Criminal mischief was reported in the 2100 block of 8th Avenue South. Criminal mischief was reported in the 600 block of North 23rd Street. A car accident was reported in the 1500 block of 4th Avenue North. Criminal mischief was reported in the 1400 block of South 22nd Street. Theft was reported in the 1400 block of South 23rd. A car accident was reported in the 1500 block of 9th Avenue South. A suspicious person was reported near 12th Avenue Southwest and 9th Street Southwest. A car accident was reported at 5th Avenue South and South 13th Street. And loud music was reported in the 700 block of South 31st Street. On Sunday, three domestic calls were reported. A fight was reported in the 300 block of O Street. Another fight in the 1000 block of 1st Avenue North. Loud music was reported in the 1300 block of 3rd Avenue Northwest. A suspicious vehicle was reported in the 1300 block of South 23rd Street. A noise disturbance was reported near South 15th Street, 6th Avenue South. A fight was reported in the 1400 block of 2nd Avenue North. Shots fired reported in the 1300 block of 4th Avenue South. A theft was reported in the 600 block of North 15th Street. A suspicious person was reported in the 900 block of Central Avenue. Criminal mischief was reported in the 1900 block of 4th Avenue South. A car accident reported at 2nd South and South 16th Street. hit and run at 14th Avenue South and 22nd Street. Theft was reported in the 1800 block of 1st Avenue South. A suspicious person was reported in the 100 block of North 10th Street. Criminal mischief was reported in the 2900 block of 20th Avenue North. A suspicious vehicle was reported in the 3100 block of 5th Avenue South. A car accident was reported in the 100 block of Kenyon Road. Another car accident was reported in the 2600 block of 200th Street. And another car accident was reported in the 2300 block of 8th Avenue North. Webster County courts this weekend on Saturday. Absence from custody charges against Andrew Nielsen, 43, of Fort Dodge. Preliminary hearing set for October 30th. Violation of parole charges against Dwayne Robinson, 59, of Fort Dodge, transferred to the Board of Parole. Disorderly conduct filed against Lucas Freese, age 40, of Badger, fined $175. On Monday, operating while intoxicated, first offense against Kayla Brandt, 22, of Rolfe. Preliminary hearing set for November 13th. Justin Fuller, 33, of 607 South 14th Street. Preliminary hearing set for November 12th. And Andrea Phillips, 35, of Fort Dodge, transferred to district court. Driving on the wrong side of a two-way highway. Charges against Kayla Brandt, 22, of Rolfe, continued for 180 days. Careless driving filed against Austin Anderson, 21, of Humboldt. Fined $112 plus. Trespassing against Robert Frost, age 54, Fort Dodge. Hearing set for December 2nd. No insurance in an accident filed against Devin Summers, 23. Received a fine of $796. Unlawful passing of school bus, Teresa Collier, 49, of Humboldt. Fined $462. No driver's license and speeding against Gary Nolan of Kansas City, Kansas, age 44, fined $354 for no driver's license and $193 for speeding. And that is the police report and courts report in the Messenger. Record numbers of people are being treated in Iowa hospitals for the coronavirus as the illness spreads across the state, according to statistics released Monday. The number of people hospitalized with the virus increased to 561, and a 14-county area of southeast Iowa reported record hospital admission patients in hospitals and patients in intensive care units. State data shows only one of Iowa's 99 counties has a 14-day positivity rate under 5%, a rate at which many public health officials recommend mitigation, such as mask wearing, social distancing, and a crowd limit requirement. 17 counties have a rate above 15%. Governor Kim Reynolds has rejected mask mandates and has lifted other measures intended to slow the virus. Reynolds typically holds a weekly news conference focused on the pandemic, but she hasn't held such a meeting for more than 2 weeks. Iowa has 677 new confirmed cases Monday and two additional deaths for a total of 1,636. Weekend numbers continue last week's high new case numbers and deaths. The state posted more than 3,000 new confirmed cases Saturday and Sunday and 17 additional deaths. In the week since October 19th, nearly 100 people have died with coronavirus infections in Iowa. Many residents in Nebraska and Iowa were breaking out shovels and snow blowers Monday following a significant snowfall, including some record snow over the weekend. Norfolk in northeastern Nebraska set a record for snowfall on Sunday with 4 inches, according to the National Weather Service. That topped the previous record of October 25th for 2.7 inches set in 1997. In Sioux City, about 3 inches of snow fell, breaking the previous record for the day of 0.7 inches more than a century ago in 1918. Higher totals were seen in communities Sunday, including 8 inches recorded in Valentine, Bassett, and Anselmo in northern Nebraska, according to the National Weather Service. In northern Iowa, the town of Ochiden saw more than 6 inches, and the communities of Sway City, Estherville, and Ringstead saw about 5 inches. In western Nebraska Panhandle, parts of Interstate 80 were closed Sunday night between Big Springs and Wyoming because of heavy snow. A woman was shot to death inside a busy Chuck E. Cheese restaurant in Davenport, police said. The shooting happened just after 7:30 Sunday and was the second of two fatal shootings Sunday in Davenport, the Quad City Times reported. Police said a woman shot another woman inside the restaurant, then fled the scene. The restaurant was full of families and children at the time of the shooting, the newspaper reported. Officers arrived to find a woman unresponsive with gunshot wounds. The victim was taken to an area hospital where she was pronounced dead. Police had not released her name and had not reported any arrests in the case by Monday morning. The shooting followed another one that happened hours earlier, around 11 o'clock a.m. Sunday outside a home, police said. Officers called to the scene found the body of Levante Lee Baker, age 19, of Davenport, lying on the grass. We'll turn over next to the sports section. Humboldt and the Cowgirls will go for state bids tonight in regional volleyball. The North Central Conference members of Humboldt and Clarion Goldfield Dallas both play for Class 3A state volleyball tournament bids on Tuesday night. The 10th-ranked Wildcats are 32-3 overall, take on number 6 MOC Floyd Valley, who are 24-4 in Shaler at 7 o'clock. Humboldt is making its 6th consecutive regional final appearance, but the program is still in search of its first ever state tourney berth. The number 2 Cowgirls are 24-2 overall and are at Webster City High School for a Region 3 championship matchup with Des Moines Christian, who are 24-13. Clarion Goldfield Dallas, the 2020 NCC gold medalist, is attempting to reach the state field for the third straight year. Head coach Katrina Turhock's squad earned their first ever state victory last fall, reaching the 2A semifinal round as the number 6 seed before bowing out with a 30-7 record. The Wildcats are led by their 8 seniors. Jory Hodgick has 312 kills, while Kendall Clark has added 225, and Emily Zog has 181. Denny McDaniel has recorded 785 assists. Zog and Lily Grote lead the way in blocks. Hodgick has 365, Clark 303, and McDaniel at 298 are the top dig performers, and Grote has tallied 47 ace serves. Hodgick, Class 3A best, 99.4%. Zog is at 97.8%, and Clark is at 96.2%. And anchor the service line as Humboldt converts 96.5% as a team. Clarion Goldfield Dallas senior Morgan Middleton, a North Dakota State University recruit, is second in 3A with 419 kills, while Cowgirl teammate Lexi Lane is first with 65 service aces as just a sophomore. University of South Dakota signee Jaden Jondo has 216 digs. Lane is the CGD leader in blocks, with Elena Frieselman and Middleton on top in serve accuracy. Jondo and Frieselman are both seniors. The state volleyball tournament is November 2nd through the 5th in Cedar Rapids. Focused on the finish is a title about Fort Dodge St. Edmund senior Audrey Bemrick. In a season like no other, Aubrey Bemrick has embraced every obstacle in front of her. Bemrick and the St. Edmund cross country team will compete at the state meet this coming Saturday inside Kennedy Park at Lakeside Golf Course, helping the St. Edmund High School girls earn a 6th consecutive bid to the final race of the year, which is exactly how Bemrick wanted to conclude her time in the sport. "It's so rewarding getting to the state and representing St. Edmund," she said. "It's also a great feeling getting to go and compete against the best in the state. The memories we created as a team when we go are the best part about it." Bemrick earned her first varsity victory earlier this year, winning the individual race in Emmitsburg as the Gales claimed the team title. She also helped her squad win the North Central Conference crowns earlier this month, placing 5th overall. "This season, I have been a bit more mentally tough, which has made practices and races feel a lot better," Bemrick said. "Physically, I think we are on really good shape from the workout our coaches give us. They are set up very well for all of us and gives us individual paces every day, which prepares us well. It's been so awesome getting to run with my senior teammates the last 3 years," she said. "It was definitely one of the best decisions that I have made joining cross country in my sophomore year. This group is more like a family than anything, I feel like. I have helped the younger runners just by setting a good example and showing them that not every day can be a good day and that's okay. Everyone has off days and it's important to move on from it and work harder the next day. Once she completes her career as a Gael, Bemerick knows it will be emotional. I will miss my team and coaches the most, she said. We spend a lot of time together and in and out of practice. It will definitely be hard having to let go of that. I just hope people at St. Edmund remember me as a hard worker. I think it's very important for not only your own goals, but your team goals as well, to always do your best. Bemerick earned All-State honors as a cheerleader last year, helping the Gales win a team title at state. Along with cross-country and cheer, Bemerick has also been involved in baseball, track, play like a champion, and respect for life at St. Edmund. Next year, she will attend the University of Iowa studying kinesiology before attending medical school. And to get to know her a little better, her vacation destination would be Greece. She'd like to have dinner with her grandpa, Grandma Bemerick and Grandpa Piper. Her sports role model is Erin Flattery. Her everyday model is her mom, and she can't go a day without her phone. Her nickname is OBS. Her most heated rivalry is Manson Northwest Webster. Favorite road trip is the CYO meet in Holstein last season when the meet was rained out, or the time the bus broke down on the way to the CYO track meet in 2019. Right now, she is listening to Luke Combs and Morgan Wallen. Her favorite team is the Iowa Hawkeyes. Her favorite class is nutrition. Favorite movie is the Toy Story series. Her favorite book is the Hunger Games series. Taking a look at area bowling information that occurred this week, Alex Markov's 300 game highlighted the recent city bowling activity. Markov's perfection came as part of a 768 series. Austin Smith was 761 and Greg Swanson followed at 760. Kayla Weiskopf at 631, Hannah Munson at 627. Turn in the high women's series totals. Munson's 707 series the week before in women's competition was the top score, followed by Jen Rollins, who had a 652. In the men's handicap league, Adam Stevenson scored a 747, and Jacob Kraft scored a 737. We'll take a look next at the hot corner for this date, October 27, 2020. In 1973, four players rushed for more than 100 yards as Alabama sets three NCAA records during a 77-6 romp over Virginia Tech. Alabama sets records with 823 yards total offense, 743 yards rushing, and four 100-yard rushers. In 1984, Iowa's Chuck Long completes 22 straight passes to set an NCAA record in a 24-28 victory over Indiana. In 1984, Sergio Lopez Chavero of Wichita State ties an NCAA record with three field goals over 50 yards in the 23-6 victory over Drake. Lopez Chavero kicks two from 54 yards and the other one from 51. In 1996, after two humbling losses at home, the Yankees win the first World Series title since 1978 with a 3-2 victory over defending champion Atlanta Braves in Game 6. On this date in 2002, Emmitt Smith breaks the NFL career rushing yardage record held by the late Walter Payton on an 11-yard run in the fourth quarter. Smith adds 109 yards and a touchdown in the 17-14 Dallas loss to Seattle and ends the game with 16,743 career yards, 17 more than Payton gained. And in 2004, the Boston Red Sox are World Series champions at long, long last. Johnny Damon homers on the fourth pitch of the game. Derek Lau makes it stand up, and the Red Sox win Game 4 over the St. Louis Cardinals. The World Series continues tonight. Game 6 has Tampa Bay versus the LA Dodgers. That will be on TV at 7 o'clock on Fox. In men's soccer, the UEFA Champions League is on at 8 o'clock on the CBS Sports Network. And in the American Football League, Spring League Conquerors versus the Generals on at 7 o'clock on Fox Sports 1. Ice fishing preparation is underway. There's still time to take advantage of open water fishing, but it's also time to think about ice fishing. This year, if you want to go on an ice fishing trip, you need to make plans now. People are fishing more than ever, and competition for lodging is intense in ice fishing country. Through the years, I've had the opportunity to ice fish on lots of bodies of water for a variety of fish species. There are a good number of places that provide pond ice fishing memories, fond ice fishing memories for me, but today I'm making plans to try to return to the following three ice fishing hotspots. My first real ice fishing trip a good number of years ago was Big Stone Lake on the Minnesota-South Dakota border. I had been there fishing open water walleyes earlier in the year, and while there was told of the ice fishing opportunities for perch. I made a return trip when the water got hard. The catching was outstanding. I've been on the ice on Big Stone several times since and continue to be impressed with the action. An angler may need to do some sorting, but we've always come up with good number of perch appropriate for the table. In the past few years, the bluegill bite has become more prominent. Big Stone has more than a few hundred true slab bluegills. A couple of hours east and north of Big Stone is the Alexandria Lakes area of Minnesota. In addition to outstanding open water region, there are a lot of ice fishing opportunities for lots of fish species in the Alex area. Panfish opportunities are plentiful, and the walleye action can be very good as well. Sometimes we forget that largemouth bass can be taken through the ice, but they can. The Alexandria area has some of the best bass fishing that can be found anywhere, open water or through the ice. Although largemouth aren't targeted frequently in very many places, if the thought of catching bass from under the ice is appealing, the Alex area is the place to make it happen. I consider Clear Lake in north central Iowa to be my home lake. It's where I caught my first walleye and where I've caught many walleye since. It's also an outstanding ice fishery for a wide variety of fish species. In recent years, Clear Lake has developed a well-deserved reputation as world-class yellow bass producer. Yellow bass are voracious feeders. When an angler gets over a school of yellows, if the appropriate bait is presented, it will be eaten. It seems that yellows are almost as willing to bite. Yellows are very prolific. They reproduce quickly. Because of this, there is no limit on yellows on Clear Lake. Keep as many as you want to clean. They're outstanding on the table. Clear Lake also provides crappie ice action, and there is a growing perch population. Now about the catching. When it comes to ice fishing and panfish, some small baits are usually best. Something in the Gen series of drop jigs will be a good choice much of the time. The tougher the bite, the smaller the jig. In clear water, start with a subtle color, but don't hesitate to try bright colors. Get the fish's attention with an aggressive jig movement, but when a fish moves in to look at your jig, slow the action down. Try tipping the jig with a Mako minnow, but go to a waxworm or spike if the fish are finicky. Wherever you fish, your sonar unit will be key. Don't fish a hole very long if you don't see fish on the sonar. If you see them and they don't bite, try a different lure size, color, or action. If they still don't bite, keep moving in search of biters. You'll eventually find some. As mentioned earlier, wherever you decide to go ice fishing, now is the time to make plans to do so. If you do, your chances for success will be much better. And that is written by Bob Jensen. Next, we'll take a quick look at the weather. Expecting sunny skies on Wednesday, a high of 45. Partly sunny Thursday, a high of 44. High around 49 on Friday under sunny skies. 55 Saturday, 49 Sunday, 56 on Monday. Temperatures in the mid-50s to high 40s throughout that time period, with lows at night in the low to mid-30s. Yesterday's high, or the high in Fort Dodge on Monday, was 34. And a year ago, we had a high of 46 degrees. We've had 4/100ths of an inch of precipitation in the past 24 hours, and an inch and a third this month, and almost 21 inches for the year. This will conclude the reading of today's Fort Dodge Messenger for October 27th. Of course, you may listen to these podcasts at iowaradioreading.org. Proud to serve IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. I'm Kevin Rogers. Thank you for joining me, and I look forward to the next time when we can visit together and read the Fort Dodge Messenger. Go out, take care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.